Because the money is made.
How do you tell?
Maybe. Yeah, I'll be ready to just go. Thank you.
I'm just going to turn this off.
Okay.
Think we become groupies of you.
Ladies and gentlemen, welcome to you all and welcome to our new series of Wednesday morning lectures. Thank you all for coming, and before I start, could you all please turn off or turn off the sound on your phones? But please do it. Don't think that it won't ring, because frequently someone's does. It just happens. It knows that you're in a lecture. I'd like to introduce Rabbi Breitowitz to those that haven't yet heard him before. Those who have, he doesn't need an introduction because he has shown the excellence of his lectures. But to those who haven't yet had the opportunity, let me tell you, Rabbi Breitowitz, his simple knowledge is just absolutely amazing, as well as unique ability to grasp complicated subjects and material, and to communicate it easily. The most difficult subjects he can communicate, making them understandable. Rabbi Breitowitz received his Bachelor of Arts from Johns Hopkins University and obtained Simcha from Neh Yisrael Rabbinical College. He graduated magna cum laude from Harvard Law School and shortly thereafter became the Rav of Silver Spring Woodside Shul in Silver Spring, Maryland, while maintaining his status as a tenured professor at the University of Maryland School of Law. Rabbi Breitowitz and his wife currently reside here in Israel, and he's a Rav in Or Samech in Yerushalayim. He has published widely on Jewish law, halakha, commercial law, bankruptcy, medical ethics, family law, and lectures extensively throughout the United States and in Israel on medical, business, and family ethics. Rabbi Breitowitz, please.
Thank you. Thank you so much. You know, they say on Rosh Chodesh you're not supposed to give hespedim, but I appreciate the very kind introduction. And again, a good Chodesh. You know, we know Mishenichnas Adar Marbim B'Simcha. When the month of Adar comes, we increase in joy. There's an argument: does that apply to the first Adar when there's a leap year? But it's mutter to be machmir. We could be machmir, and we could be Marbim B'Simcha in Adar Rishon as well. If those of you that have been here through all of the series know that we've really gone through, really, in a way, it's very difficult to shift gears. We started with Rav Kook, and then we went to Yehuda Halevi, and then we went to the Tanya, and now we go to the Rambam. So in a sense, it's a little difficult to keep my balance, because they do represent, although all of them are Torah Hashem, of course, but they do represent very, very different ways of looking at things, and therefore it's sometimes, at least for me, it's a little hard to get adjusted. And I'm still with Rav Kook about 7 or 8 months ago, and the like. But of course, we are going to be studying one of the works of, indeed, one of the greatest Jews that really ever lived, Rav Moshe ben Maimon. As you know, he's buried in Tiberia. And on his matseva, it says, "Mi Moshe ad Moshe, lo kam kemoshe." From Moshe Rabbeinu till Moshe ben Maimon, there was no one as great as Moshe. So indeed, when we confront the towering, amazing stature of the Rambam, that is still the Mora Ledorot, he is the teacher for all of the generations. we must approach it with a great deal of awe and trepidation. Although in many, many ways, the Rambam, who was the rationalist par excellence, in fact was not the derech that was later adopted by the Kabbalah and by the Hasidic movements. And in many, many ways, Kabbalah and Hasidut actually entered the mainstream of Yiddishkeit, in which case the Rambam is a bit outside of that mainstream, as strange as that is to say, that for various reasons, the pure rationalistic tradition that started with Rav Sadra Gaon and really culminated in the Rambam is in fact not the mainstream position. Again, I'm not going to editorialize or even opine whether that is the right way or not the right way, but it is a fact that in fact much of the Rambam's Mahalech was not adopted by later authorities. And yet, the work we're going to be looking at is a work that indeed still has eternal value. Just a few comments about the Rambam's life. The Rambam, as you know, was born in Spain at a time when it was occupied by the Muslims, by the Moors, as opposed to Ramban, that was born in Catholic Spain a generation later. And initially, things were relatively benign, but then you had the Almohads, which were a fanatic Islamic sect. And because of this, the Rambam's family, when he was a child, was wandering from place to place to place. There was even a short time that they lived in Eretz Yisrael. And the Rambam records his visits to the Kotel Maravi, which at the time was only a small, right, because the ground level was covered with garbage and refuse over hundreds and hundreds of years. It was only a few inches peeping up. But still, the Jews that came were mitzpalel, and the Rambam even writes that all of his life he celebrated as a Yom Tov the day that he was zocheh to pray at the Kotel Maravi. There is no record of the Rambam actually going to the Har HaBayit. In fact, the implication is, I don't want to get into that controversy, but the implication seems to be the opposite. He only went to the Kotel, he didn't go past the Kotel. How that would apply with contemporary Psakim would be an interesting question. But eventually his family had to leave the land of Israel as well, because this Almohad persecution kept on following them from place to place to place to place, till they finally came to Egypt, which was also Islamic, but Egypt was a more benign. And it is recorded that the Rambam had some ambivalence, and the Rambam spent the rest of his life, around 45 years, he spent in Egypt. In particular, the old part of Cairo that was called Fostat, and in addition to being the eminent posek that he was, he became the royal physician to the Grand Vizier, and he spent much of his day taking care of the various people in the royal courts. He was also the rabbi of a shul. He was the rabbi of the Fostat Kehillah. And interestingly enough, as rabbi, you know, it's so fascinating. You know, here you have the Gadol Hador, and yet, as synagogue rabbi, he had the same problems all synagogue rabbis had. He had a major problem with talking in the shul during the Shabbos davening. And because of this, some things don't change. And because of this, the Rambam as Rav, it's not in the Mishneh Torah, it's not in his halachic work, he actually abolished the repetition of the Amidah in Musaf of Shabbat. Basically, the Chazan recited the three brachos and Kedusha, and then people finished the silent Shemona Esrei. He did this specifically because of the great amount of talking that existed, but that became the Yemenite custom. And Ad Hayom Hazeh, if you ever go to a Kehilah of Teimanim, you will find that they do not recite a complete Chazarat Hashatz for the Tefillah of Musaf. Now again, I don't think it's because they have a talking problem. As a matter of fact, the Teimanim actually do not have a talking problem, but I'll get to this. They considered the Rambam so sacrosanct that not only did they follow all of the halachic rulings in his compendium, but even the private practices that they were aware of, they incorporated into their liturgy. I'll explain why that was so. It is recorded that the Rambam had some ambivalence about spending his life in Egypt. Because after all, there actually is a prohibition in the Torah to return to the land of Egypt. And it is recorded that on a number of letters the Rambam signs, Moshe ben Maimon, he who transgresses three prohibitions of the Torah every single day by living in Egypt, there are three times. Now, I have to say that although this is recorded, and indeed we do have letters where allegedly the Rambam signed his name that way, many historians say those letters are forgeries. And in fact, there halachically is no prohibition on a Jew living in Egypt, simply because the Torah's prohibition is not referring to the geographical country occupied by Egypt, but it refers to returning to the ancient Egyptians when they lived there. And obviously today the modern Egyptians are an Arabic people, they are not the ancient Egyptians. So al pi halacha, there is no Israel. As you may know, Ravaji Yosef himself, although he was born in Eretz Yisrael, served as a rabbi in Egypt, and in fact Egypt had over the years, not today, but over the years had distinguished Kehilot and distinguished Rabbanim, and none of them considered it to be prohibited to live in Egypt. But be it as it may, the Rambam did spend 45 years there, and it's very interesting that at least in one respect the Rambam was a hypocrite. What do I mean? That sounds like a very irreverent thing to say. The Rambam writes in the Mishneh Torah that a person should get 8 hours of sleep every night in order to serve Hashem properly. Well, he was a hypocrite, because I can guarantee you he never got 8 hours of sleep. And in fact, he describes his schedule. It was very interesting. As a younger man, he was actually supported by his brother. He had an older brother, David. And David was a jewel merchant who used to accumulate jewels and sell them and the like. And David supported his brother, so his brother could sit and learn Torah and philosophy and write Svarim and the like. This was a classical Yisachar Zevulun partnership. And although, interestingly enough, and this one could write a whole book on this, the Rambam was very much against people sitting and learning and being supported by the community. He thought it was wrong. He thought you have to work. The Rambam was not against family arrangements, because that was indeed what supported him. But his brother David died in a shipwreck in the Indian Ocean. And that, of course, deprived the Rambam of his economic support. But also, the Rambam was very emotionally close to his brother, and he mentions that he essentially had the equivalent of a nervous breakdown for an entire year. He was confined to bed, etc. He literally did not want to live. Eventually, he became a doctor, Midocha Kaparnasa, simply because he had no other way of making a living. For a while, by the way, he actually made his living as a college professor, and I mean that quite literally, that he was a lecturer in Islamic philosophy in a non-Jewish institution. Now, of course, when I say Islamic philosophy, you have to know what I mean. Obviously, he had no interest in teaching the religion of Islam. That was not what he wanted to do. But you have to remember that during the 12th century, when the Rambam lived, the 1100s, this was the dark ages in Christian Europe. Christian Europe was largely going through a period of great illiteracy and lack of culture and lack of erudition. The cultured part of the world were the Islamic culture. They were the preservers of classical philosophy, which meant Aristotle. And Aristotle had been translated from the Greek into Latin, but then eventually into Arabic and the like. And essentially, the way it reached the Islamic world was through the Arabic, not only translations, but the Arabic interpreters of Aristotle, such as Al-Farabi and the like. And the Rambam, for a while, was a professor of this Aristotelian philosophy. This is how he had to make a living. Listen, there weren't that many yeshivas in Spain at the time, and they weren't paying that well. It reminds me a little bit of Rav Soloveitchik, who in many ways is very similar to the Rambam, Rav Yosef Dov Soloveitchik, who, when he first was hired, when his father was still alive, Rav Moshe Soloveitchik, so Rav Yosef Ber Soloveitchik was not hired to be a Magid Shir. He was hired as a professor of philosophy, and in fact he taught philosophy in Yeshiva College. fact, I've even seen copies of the exams he used to give and some of his comments. So he actually was a secular philosopher, a secular professor, before he became a Magid Shir and a Rosh Yeshiva. The Rambam was a secular professor of philosophy, but eventually he became a doctor. In those days, you didn't have to go to medical school for so many years, so it was a little easier to become a doctor in the Middle Ages. But eventually, he rose to be the royal doctor. And he describes his schedule in a letter, which, as I said, he was a hypocrite, because he did not sleep 8 hours, he did not sleep 6 hours. It's not clear that he slept 4 or 5 hours. And that is, he basically says that he would leave every morning and he spent the whole day in the royal palace, because there were so many, you know, people, all sorts of people who needed different medical treatments and the like. And then towards evening he would ride his donkey home, and when he got home, and he had not eaten anything all day because I guess there was no kosher food and whatever it was, he couldn't have anything to eat. He says he was famished. He was physically exhausted. And there was a long line of people, like 100 people, waiting to see him. Some of them were patients, because he treated Jews as well, who wanted to see their doctor. Others were rabbis or other people that had she'elot in halacha. There were community issues that he had to deal with. Right? And this is already, he says, he often did not come home, he said, till 8 o'clock at night. And he had not eaten all day, and he had this whole line of people. And he asked people to wait for 15 minutes so he could eat something. And then he would see them. And he said he would often be seeing people on all of these different matters until midnight. And only after midnight did he do his writing. So the great, great, magnificent books, I'll talk about which books they were, that we have, were written after midnight. I don't know how many hours. We don't know how many hours he wrote every night. And you know, that's what the Rambam was. So as I say, his Eitza Tova about sleeping 8 hours a night was an Eitza Tova that he himself was not able to follow in his life. But he was an extraordinarily busy person, busy with international Jewish issues, and busy with many, many local issues, as well as medicine. Now, we do know that the Rambam has many, many works, including works on medicine, which are still, you know, useful. He was indeed one of the great physicians of the Middle Ages, and even though we say, oh, that's primitive stuff, but nevertheless, there are certain insights, even in the Rambam's medical works, that are still very, very worthy of attention. In fact, there's even a diet book out there, kind of how to lose weight according to the Rambam, and they even have it. I understand it's worked for a number of people, but the Rambam's insight, and the Rambam was one of the first to notice it. The Rambam's insight was that nutrition is fundamental to health, and many, many sicknesses come from an imbalance of diet or overeating or the like. And the Rambam writes that, and indeed, you know, that absolutely is true to this very day. So we do have the Rambam's medical writings, but in terms of his Jewish writings, there are three basic works which give him immortal fame. The first work, which he wrote at the young age of 27, before he even got to Spain, and this was written on the run, as his family is running from place to place to place to place. He wrote a commentary on the six orders of the Mishnah, the Perish HaMishnayos LaHarambam. Now, this was a pivotal work. He wrote it in Arabic, interestingly enough, because he wanted people to understand. The Mishnah is, of course, the foundation of the oral law, but it is explained by the Gemara, but many people couldn't learn Gemara. It was too convoluted, too complicated, too complex, too involved, too detailed. So he was, now we have many commentaries on Mishnah, but he really was the first one. He kind of takes a synopsis of what the Gemara says on the Mishnah, and explains it, and also gives you the halacha, because the Mishnah will give you different opinions, and the Rambam, as a young man, would indicate what view was the halacha. This is called the Perish HaMishnayos LaHarambam. It was written in Arabic. Eventually it was translated into Hebrew. And really, every standard shas does have the Perish HaMishnayos of the Rambam in the back. Recently, the Rambam's Arabic works have been retranslated in a more flowing modern Hebrew, because the medieval Hebrew translation is a bit awkward. because it tries to mirror Arabic syntax. That's always a difficulty when you translate from one language to another language. Syntactical structures are different. In fact, that's been a problem, for example, even in more modern times with the translations of Rav Shimshon Raphael Hirsch. That's why there's actually a newer translation now. German is a very dense language. Sentences are very long. If you ever look at German sentence, might be 800 words long till you get to a period and the like. And some of the earlier translations of Rav Hirsch were translating English with Germanic sentence structures, which for the American, well, American, the English-speaking reader, is very, very difficult. You know, we've lost our attention spans anyway, so when you have a long sentence of more than 50 words, we forget what the beginning of the sentence said. So that's kind of a problem with the Rambam as well, that Arabic, again, I'm not an expert, I don't know Arabic, but Arabic sentence structures are different than Hebrew sentence structures. And the Ibn Tibbon family, who are really renowned translators of Arabic into Hebrew, of many, many Svarim, their translations tend to be Arabic in style. And that's why Rav Kapach Zatzal, and even more recently other Avreichim, have retranslated the Rambam's works in a much more flowing, modern Hebrew. So if you're into that, you may want to consider the newer translations of Moreh Nevuchim and commentary to the Mishnah and the like. But what is very unique about the Rambam's commentary to the Mishnah is not only the commentary itself, which is very, very special, but the Rambam has introductions to certain sections, which are technically part of the commentary of the Mishnah, but they are really works on their own that are extremely valuable. For example, to his commentary to the Mishnah, he wrote an introduction to the Mishnah. The introduction to the Mishnah is a magnificent essay on the meaning of the written law and the oral law, and the fact that there's a bifurcated Torah, and what is the process of rabbinic interpretation. And he identifies all of the different strands of the oral law. Part of it was given to Moshe. Part of it represents innovation and dynamism of rabbinic interpretation. Part of it is rabbinic legislation, which is not interpreting the Torah, but new legislation. And the Rambam carefully differentiates the different strands. You know, a lot of people to this day, very orthodox and well-meaning people, in fact, very from people, very, very from people, they'll make a statement like, every word of the Gemara was handed down from Moshe, from God to Moshe, and it was handed down orally until such time as it was written down, because there was a risk of it being forgotten. Now, that's well-meaning, and that's coming from a very sincere place, obviously. But the truth is, it's a ridiculous position. I mean, you read a page of Gemara, and it says, Abaya asks a question. Rava gives an answer. What was Abaya told? Abaya is a person who lived in a certain century, right? The second century of the Common Era. Was Abaya handed a script saying, we have a tradition from Moshe Rabbeinu that you are supposed to say these words on this day, and you, Rava, here. I mean, this is crazy. I mean, obviously, Tanoim and Amoraim were saying what they thought, what was in their minds. They were not reading from some predetermined script. So we then have a question, but what do you mean? Don't we say the Torah Shebaal Peh was given from Hashem? So what is this thing about Abaye, Rava, Hillel, Shammai? And how do you get machlokas anyway? One says kosher, one says treif. Didn't God tell Moshe the answer? These are good questions, and the Rambam addresses these questions. The Rambam, in the introduction, right, in the introduction to the Mishnah, he addresses all of these issues by indicating that Hashem gave Moshe a core of principles, and it was left to the Chachamim to flesh them out through debate, through discussion, through logic, through analogy. Torah Shebaal Peh is not a matter of simply transmitting pre-existing information. It's a matter of taking that information and utilizing it in new and creative ways. And that is why the Rambam says, Machloket is not inconsistent with revelation. People ask the question, how can there be arguments if God gave an answer. The answer is, God gave the tools and the raw materials out of which answers are formulated, but the actual answers are left to us. That's why, even if God says our answer is wrong, our answer is correct. That's Lo B'Shamayim, the Torah is not in heaven. If you remember the famous Gemara where a certain rabbi was overruled and he had Hashem on his side, and the rabbi said to Hashem, keep out of this, God, we will decide what you want, not you, because you said Lo B'Shamayim he. And that sounds pretty nervy, pretty chutzpahdik, but the Gemara says that Eliyahu HaNavi asked Hashem, or somebody asked Eliyahu HaNavi, what did God respond when they said Lo B'Shamayim? He says, God laughed and he said, Nitzchuni Banai, my children have won, I'm going to keep out of the fight. Now, the only way you understand this, though, is that revelation is God gives us the raw materials. Now, that's why for every person who is interested in Torah Shebaal Peh, the introduction to the commentary of the Mishnah, which has, by the way, been translated in English as a separate work, is really such a vital, vital, vital work to understand the oral law, revelation, the infallibility of the Chachamim. And then, as an aside, which has nothing to do with this topic even, he discusses the idea of Agadita, the non-legal portions of the Talmud, and he introduces the very important idea that people create a false dichotomy. People always ask, is Agadita true or is it Baba Maita? Vashti had a tail, right? Is it true? And the Rambam says, some people are foolish that they believe everything is literally true, and that's foolish. And some people are sarcastic and cynical, and they say it's made up superstition. The Rambam says that's a false dichotomy, because everything is true, but truth is sometimes symbolic and not literal. And the Chachamim employed metaphor, hyperbole, not to simply tell you a crazy story, but they are communicating deep spiritual insights. And he made a... Remember, the Rambam wrote this at 27. This is not things he wrote at the end of his life. And he even makes a promise to us, which unfortunately he was not able to keep, as far as we know, that he will write a commentary on the Agada of the Talmud to show us what those symbolic meanings will be for each of those teachings. This is one of the great unfinished works that we have. We really do not have. Now, this is what the Maharal tried to do much, much later, but we do not have the Rambam's own interpretation of this. So that's one thing. I just want to list the Hakdamos, introductions in the commentary to the Mishnah. So we have the Hakdama to the whole commentary, which is the legal structure of Torah Shebaal Peh. Then we have a Hakdama to Pirkei Avos. The Hakdama to Pirkei Avos is actually bigger than Pirkei Avos. Pirkei Avos is the one treatise of the Mishnah that does not deal so much with halacha, it deals with ethics and morality. The Rambam wrote an introduction to his commentary to Pirkei Avos called Shmona Perakim, the 8 chapters. And this will be the Rambam's theory of ethics, morality, character building, and the like. Now it's interesting, Pirkei Avot is only 5 chapters of Mishnah and one later chapter of Brisa. So the Rambam wrote an introduction of 8 chapters to a tractate that only has 5 chapters. But okay, that's all right. Now, it's interesting, though, that because Shmona Prakim, which is the subject of our learning, is learned as a separate work, the Rambam wrote a little introduction to his introduction. Very short, though, very short. And the translator, Rav Shmuel ibn Tibon, who knew the Rambam personally, and the Rambam did trust him very much, and Shmuel ibn Tibon translated Mordechai, translated all of the Rambam's Arabic works, actually wrote his own introduction because he wanted to get a little thing in himself. Because I want to tell you something, a thought of mine. You know, translators not. Now this is a conflict. I know some people who are signers for deaf people, but they sign, right? They sign, they do sign language and the like. So it's interesting that the person I knew was a bit of an Orthodox woman, but she was a bit of a feminist, maybe a little bit to the left wing. And sometimes she had to sign very Haredi type lecturers who were saying things that she did not agree with. And she talked about the conflicts of, I got to sign something that, you know, I think is totally wrong. So translators have the same problem, right? A translator is not supposed to add his own stuff. In fact, the Gemara even gives a story, not about a translator, but about a maturgamon that was the ancient public address system in which a Tana or an Amora would teach, and there'd be somebody who would broadcast it. So there was, and so sometimes the broadcasters were themselves big Talmidei Chachamim, but they didn't have their own yeshiva. They were employed as translators for other people. So sometimes the translator wanted to add his own little chiddush. So it mentions that the wife of the rabbi that was giving the shir, I guess the rabbi was concentrating on his shir, but the wife was listening, and she says, he didn't say what you said, he's saying something else. So Rav said, as long as he's saying Torah, who cares? Let it be his Torah, let it be my Torah. The main thing is that people learn. It's reminiscent of a remark with the Shlomo Zalman Orbach. Somebody once went to Shlomo Zalman Orbach and said, this person is saying over his chidushim in his name, which are really your chidushim. He's not giving you credit. So Shlomo Zalman said, I don't care if he says my stuff in his name, as long as he doesn't say his stuff in my name. That's going to be... Okay. In other words, you know, if what I said is MS, I don't care if he says it in my name or his name, I don't care. But if he says things in my name already, then I don't want it to be. Okay. But be it as it may, so that's what the Shmona Prakim. The Shmona Prakim is the Rambam's introduction to Pirkei Avot, in which the Rambam lays down the foundations for ethical change. But as an aside, he talks about the purpose of ethical change. Why be ethical? And interestingly enough, the Rambam does not regard ethics as an end in and of itself, but ethics is an indispensable mechanism for knowing and understanding God. In fact, the Rambam uses the phrase machitza. A machitza is a wall that separates man from God. And the Rambam says, when there are midos, b'chutot in a person, when there's negative character traits, these are barriers and walls that prevent a person from knowing and connecting to God. And therefore, Pirkei Avot is the stepping stone to be connected to Hashem by learning to improve one's midot. So that's Hakdama number two. So we have the Hakdama to the whole Mishnah, which we might say is the Rambam's understanding of the halachic system. We have the Hakdama to Pirkei Avot, which is the Rambam's understanding of ethical and moral character development. And then there's a third major Hakdama, and that is his Hakdama to the 11th Perek of Sanhedrin. Now, the 11th Perek of Sanhedrin, which actually in the Rambam's Mishnah it's the 10th Perek, but we have it the 11th Perek, that's the famous Perek, which is almost totally Agadah. It's the largest block of Agadah in the whole Talmud. That deals with Olam Haba, and who is a heretic, etc. Who will have a share in the world to come, who will not have a share in the world to come. And of course the Rambam explains every Mishnah, but he decided to give an introduction in which he articulates what is Olam Haba, what is Techiyat HaMeish, because there are a lot of different terms we use for what you might call Jewish eschatology, meaning what happens at the end of days, the end of time. And some of these words people throw around as interchangeable. They talk about the days of Mashiach, they talk about Olam Haba, they talk about Gan Eden, they talk about Techiyat HaMeishim. And the Rambam, with his laser-like precision of definition, differentiates each of these terms, that Olam Haba is the world of the soul, not the world of the body. There is no physical pleasure in Olam Haba, because there is no body. And of course he's countering the Islamic view of the virgins and everything else. There is no eating, there is no drinking. There is only the connection of the soul to its source in God. And that is a pleasure that is beyond any earthly pleasure. as opposed to Yemot HaMashiach, which is very much something that happens in this world with the building of the Beit HaMikdash and the Kibbutz Galuyos. But Mashiach, people will still die. And then at the end of time, there'll be Tchiyat HaMetim, which is the physical resurrection. And once the Rambam gets on to that, that's the joining of the body and the soul, then the Rambam goes in to articulate the 13 principles of faith. And if you want to know, where does the Rambam articulate the 13 basic principles of faith? This is in the Hakdama to Perek Chelek, the Hakdama to the 11th Perek of Sanhedrin, where the Rambam uses this as an excuse. Now let me just mention a few things. The formulation in the Siddur, Ani ma'amin bi'amunah shalema, I believe, and that mentions 13 principles, that is not the Rambam's lashon. The Rambam did not write Ani ma'amin. That was written by an anonymous author later, who took the Rambam's principles and formulated them into a credo beginning with the words Ani ma'amin bi'amunah shalema. I mean, if you want to know the Rambam's words, at least as they are translated into Hebrew, you can look into the Perush HaMishnayos in Sanhedrin, and you will find it. In addition, as many of you probably know, the very popular song that many people sing, Yigdal, is also a poetic paraphrase of the Yud Gimel Ikrei Emunah. Now, let me point out that the Rambam's formulation of 13 principles of faith was a much more controversial operation than you might assume. And it was controversial for two reasons, two very, very different reasons. Reason number one is, what does it mean to say something's fundamental? I mean, for example, one of the Rambam's principles is that every word of the Torah was given by God to Moshe. So the Abarbanel argues, if you have to believe in everything in the Torah, then how can you then sing? I mean, it's kind of crazy. You're basically saying you have to believe that God doesn't have a body and God doesn't have a physical form, and then you have to believe in the whole Torah. So if you have to believe in the whole Torah, why are you enumerating parts of the Torah that you have to believe in? What does it make sense to say we enumerate specific things if one of your specific things is, and you got to believe in everything? So the Abarbanel argued, it's not shayach to say that one part of the Torah is an ikar and another part is not, if one of the ikarim itself is that everything is true. But the answer to that is the following. Let's say a person doesn't know everything in the Torah. All of us are in that situation one way or the other. So here is the point. If I believe everything in the Torah is true, I have satisfied this ikar, even if I don't know what's in the Torah, just like Nasa v'Nishma. But if I am ignorant, let's assume I am ignorant, I think God has a body simply because I haven't been taught that way. With the ikarim, ignorance is no, that's the argument, ignorance is no defense, meaning you must know that God is one. You must know God has a body. You don't have to know that there's Shabbos. Now, what I mean to say is, if a person believes the Torah comes from God, but doesn't know there's a mitzvah of Shabbos, that's very unfortunate. But if he never learned, he is not a heretic, as long as he believes the Torah comes from God. But if you don't believe the Torah comes from God, even if that is a result of the way you were raised, according to many commentaries, this is an argument, you would still be a heretic. Meaning, what makes something an ikar is you must know it. It is the admission ticket for Olam Haba. It is the admission ticket. If you don't have it because you're poor in knowledge, that's too bad. But even a poor person doesn't gain admission to the movie theater without paying the admission. The Yud Gimel Ikrim, according to the Rambam, is the ticket for theological admission. Now, if you're going to ask me, or ask the Rambam, well, what's going to be if a person just never learned it? Is that fair? So here, the Kabbalist answered, there's reincarnation. I don't know if the Rambam would accept that. But reincarnation means, all right, you'll get a second chance, and a third chance, and a fourth chance. Hashem will keep on giving you the chances. till you get it. Okay. So that was one issue, meaning is there such a thing as Ikrim? Meaning the whole Torah is Ikrim. The second argument is that maybe Judaism doesn't care about theology at all. Maybe the most important thing in Judaism, of course you have to believe in God, I would assume that everybody would say, if you don't believe in God, you know, you're a heretic. But short of that, if I believe in God and I keep God's commandments, why is it important that I have a particular theological orientation? It was often said that Judaism is about deed more than creed, and the ikar should be that you do mitzvot, and not whether you have theologically precise beliefs. And people pointed out, contemporaries of the Rambam, that Chazal in the Talmud and the Medrash seem to be very unsystematic about theology, and there seem to be many theologies going around there. And the Rambam was, some say, was overly rigid in prescribing this as things you must believe in. Right? There were some commentaries that question the whole legitimacy of giving a detailed theology of Judaism, other than perhaps there is a God and God gave the Torah. Now, there was a famous book that was written around 200 years after the Rambam, Rav Yosef Albo, who basically said, there are not 13 fundamental principles. There is only 3 fundamental principles. And he differentiated between what he called ikarim, which are roots, versus sharashim, versus which are called anafim, which are branches. And he said, a lot of things that the Rambam called ikarim, if properly understood, should be anafim. Now, Rav Yosef Albo's 3 principles are the following. There is a God who created heaven and earth. There is a system of reward for goodness and punishment for evil. And third principle, there is a revelation of God's will through the giving of the Torah. Now, what he says is the following. If you believe in God, you have satisfied Iker number 1, even if you think God may have a body. Now, Rav Yosef Albo was not saying God has a body, but he's saying that if somebody labored under that mistake, they would be a fool, but they would not be a heretic. See, according to the Rambam, they would be a heretic because they're denying the Ikar, that God doesn't have a body. According to Rav Yosef Albo, as long as you believe that God created heaven and earth, the nature of God is a matter of learning and study, and there are true beliefs and false beliefs. Now, this is an important idea. A person could be totally wrong, but that is not the same as heresy or apostasy. Another example. Let's say I don't believe in Mashiach. Rav Albo says that's an erroneous belief because Judaism believes in a Mashiach. But as long as you believe in reward and punishment, let's assume a person had a belief that reward and punishment takes place in the world to come, and there's not going to be a physical Mashiach. According to the Rambam, that is heresy. That is apikorsis. That is kefira. According to Rav Yosef Albo, that is a mistaken belief, but it is not a heretical belief. As long as you do believe that God ultimately rewards good and punishes virtue, rewards good and punishes evil, I'm sorry, you're correct, then, in other words, God is not indifferent to human virtue and vice, then you have complied with your emunah and nikkur. That's why people misunderstand Rav Albo, because people sometimes read Rav Albo as saying, oh, Rav Albo didn't believe in Mashiach, Rav Albo didn't believe in God being incorporeal. Not true. He did believe in it, but he classified them as anaf and not ikar. Okay, so that's a whole issue. In fact, Mark Shapiro is a very, 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 very interesting, he's a from person, but well, most people say he's from, I say he's from, but he's a professor in the United States. Very, very provocative, very, very interesting person, controversial person. He wrote a whole book assembling many, many Rishonim who argue on a number of the Rambam's fundamental principles. And these are Rishonim, not modern writers. These are Rishonim that we are Makabel, whether it's Ramban or Ravid or the like. So the 13 principles are not necessarily the last word in a lot of these things. Of course, to put it another way, some say that the Jewish Orthodox world has become so intolerant that if the Rambam himself were to come back, he would be condemned as a heretic who doesn't believe the 13 principles of faith. For example, what would the Rambam say about introducing math in elementary schools? You know, the guess would be the Rambam would be relatively in favor of it, but okay. Yeah.
Why are these books?
Yeah, I'll get to that. Okay. Now, again, I'm giving you kind of a summary of the commentary to the Mishnah. So I mentioned three introductions so far. The introduction to the Mishnah is the structure of the halachic system. The introduction to Pirkei Avos is the structure of the ethical system. The introduction to Perek Chelek is the introduction to the theological system. In addition, for those of you who are interested in the real nitty-gritty of halacha, the introduction to the order of Taharos, the last order of the Mishnah, which is the most difficult order, it has no Gemara on it, except for Maseches Nida, deals with the laws of purity and impurity. This is an extremely difficult and technical system that has hundreds and hundreds of rules that are so difficult to synthesize and put together. And the Rambam wrote a phenomenal introduction, organizing and systematizing the laws of purity and impurity. Now, this has to be something you are really interested in. I mean, I happen to be really interested in it, but it's not for the totally general reader. But it just shows you that the Rambam did not allow his great interest in philosophy to obscure his great commitments to halachic nitty-gritty at the most granular level. And that's again, and by the way, the Rambam seems to have been unusually proud of that introduction. He kind of writes, I am the first one that's done this, the first one that's gone into this morass and tried to impose some order. So in the Perush HaMishnayot as an overall work, the introductions have a very, very special importance. And amazingly enough, as I indicated, these were written when the Rambam was younger than 30, although he did revise them throughout his life, and that is why sometimes we have first editions, second editions, third editions. The Rambam did make changes in his work. Now, in the ancient world, this was a very, very difficult thing to pull off because the distribution system, you know, people had manuscripts, and the Rambam changes something, how does it get, you know, from here to there? It wasn't like an email or something like that. Okay. Now, the second major work, right, so Perush HaMishnayos, the Rambam wrote as a young man. In his middle ages, in his 50s, when he is at the height of his career as a doctor and a rav and a leader, he spent 10 years after midnight, burning the midnight oil, writing what is really indeed the greatest code of Jewish law that was ever written. And this was called, now this is the only work he wrote that was written in Mishnayic Hebrew. He wrote it in Hebrew because he said this would be his enduring work. And this goes by two names. The name that the Rambam himself gave it is called Mishneh Torah. Now, Mishneh Torah literally means the second Torah. And he makes a claim in his introduction that all you need is a Chumash for the written Torah and my compendium, which will give you all of the halachic rulings from the oral law, which is the Talmud, and the Babylonian Talmud, the Jerusalem Talmud, the Tosefta, and that's all you need. You'll have the written Torah and the oral Torah, and you could skip the Talmudic discussions. Now that itself was a big controversial step. People accused the Rambam, oh, are you trying to replace the Gemara? And the Rambam said, I'm not trying to replace the Gemara, but for many people, the Gemara is so complicated, and the Gemara has many opinions, and the Gemara doesn't tell you who the halacha is like, etc. So the Rambam attempted, in 14 books, to encapsulate the entire corpus of the oral law, the Torah Shebaal Peh. Now, the name that the book was given by later people is called Yad HaChazakah, the strong hand. Now, this is actually a double pun in some ways. Because at the end of the Torah, when Moshe died, it says there was no one like Moshe because of his yada chazakah, because of his strong and mighty hand that he did for the Jewish people. So the Rambam, whose name was Moshe, was given the appellation yada chazakah. And the other reason is yad bigamatria is 14. So the Mishneh Torah has 14 books. Now, the truth of the matter is, if we look at the Rambam's goal in writing the Mishneh Torah, that goal failed, but he accomplished other goals. His goal was to simplify and streamline halachic Judaism by eliminating long and complex discussions and giving people the bottom line. His goal was, you don't have to get involved in complicated discussions and alternative possibilities. I will just give you the answer. His purpose was to simplify. Well, in the Jewish world, that purpose almost never works. Because what immediately happened was, people started writing commentaries on the Rambam. And they would argue with the Rambam. And they would try to figure out his sources, because he doesn't tell you his sources. Because he doesn't want to tell you his sources. Because the whole point is, just trust me. Now the Rambam was indeed big enough to make that claim. But Jews don't like to trust, you know. And as a result, the Rambam says, why should I trust you? You know, tell me your sources. But of course, what happened there was, people had to go back to the Gemara and reopen it and reinterpret it. So if you look at how many commentaries there are in the Rambam, there are thousands of commentaries on the Rambam. And then later we have the Shulchan Aruch, and this happened over and over again. And that's why the Torah was written, because from the Rambam it got too complicated. The Torah wanted to simplify. But then you have the Beis Yosef and the Bach, right? So the Shulchan Aruch wanted to simplify. And then you have 100 commentaries on the Shulchan Aruch. So what happens basically is, that life is too complicated, Jews are too cantankerous. There's never a concept of simplifying. You try to simplify and it breaks out. So the Rambam's own stated goal in the Mishneh Torah was actually unsuccessful. But still, in terms of organization, in terms of style, in terms of clarity, and in terms of comprehensiveness, it is the greatest code of Jewish law ever written. I mean, let me just remind you. The Rambam's code covers everything. It covers the laws of sacrifices, the laws of purity and impurity, the laws of agriculture, which Baruch Hashem are now relevant in Eretz Israel, but for hundreds of years were not so relevant. Unlike the Shulchan Aruch, which was written hundreds of years later, which only covers the laws that were practical at the time, and that's why in the Shulchan Aruch we don't have the laws of kachim, the laws of sacrifices, and the laws of purity. So the Rambam to this day is the most comprehensive code, but it also stylistically is the most elegant, it is the best organized, it is the most eloquent, and the Rambam also integrates in little pockets here and there philosophical perspectives on Jewish law, which the Shulchan Aruch does not do. Right, this was the Mishneh Torah. Now, the Mishneh Torah, on one hand, was very, very respected, but it did create controversy. Number one, people accused the Rambam of trying to get rid of the Gemara. That was one thing. Number two, they criticized the Rambam for not revealing his sources. And number three, they sometimes said that the Rambam's rulings either contradicted themselves or they contradicted Talmudic passages. Now, this is an interesting example of what's called reverse engineering. Because here's the problem, and this is what you do in advanced yeshiva learning. This is actually what you do. The Rambam did not give us a commentary on the Gemara the way Rashi did. The Rambam gave us final rulings. But the final rulings have to be based on the Talmud. But sometimes it's apparent, when you learn the Rambam, that the Rambam could not have understood the Talmudic discussion the way Rashi did. Because if he did understand the Talmudic discussion the way Rashi did, he could not have come out with his conclusion. So, how did the Rambam understand the Talmudic discussion? We don't know, because he didn't tell us. So that's what I mean by reverse engineering. You're looking at the final product, which is the Rambam's halachic ruling, and you move backwards to try to figure out how he must have understood the Talmud in order to come up with that ruling. You see, that's an important point. That's why students are sometimes very confused, because they learn the Gemara and then they learn the Halacha, and the Halacha doesn't seem to be consistent with what the Gemara said. But the reason is, they're learning the Gemara with Rashi's explanation, but the Shulchan Aruch is usually based on the Rambam, who didn't give us an explanation, but he must have had a different explanation. So that is the process of what I call reverse engineering. It's similar to taking a finished product and trying to figure out how it was made by looking at the finished product. Yeah?
So when writing, you don't want to quote a secondary source, you want to quote a primary source.
Yep.
According to what you're saying now, the Rambam really is the secondary source, and the primary source is the various arguments in the Gemara.
Well,
how far back would you go?
No. The Rambam is absolutely a primary source, because the Rambam is the one that gave you the rule. The Gemara doesn't give you rules. The Gemara gives you a process of discussion. So obviously, you know, if you want to draw an analogy, the Rambam would be like the United States Code, and the Gemara would be like the Congressional Record. So everything is based on those discussions. But the Talmud itself does not give you a final discussion, a final ruling. So the Rambam is a primary source. Absolutely. Now, I don't mean we paskin. So, I mean, we don't always paskin like the Rambam. But if you're quoting a halachic rule, you don't have to go past the Rambam. I mean, you could add based on, you know, Rambam based on Talmud Bavli, but you don't have to do that. Okay, now let me mention, we're going to end here, but let me mention, I'm going to get to the Rambam's burning, probably have to do it the next time we meet, that the Rambam's third great work, the Rambam wrote towards the end of his life, and this got him in the most trouble of all. The Mishnah Torah got him into some trouble, and that is the Mora Nevuchim. Now this was back to Arabic again. And Mora Nevuchim means guide to the perplexed, or the instructor for those who are navuch, those who are confused. And this started off as a very long letter to a beloved disciple, Yosef ibn Aknin. And Yosef ibn Aknin was very, very perturbed, because he wanted to be a religious Jew. But there were a number of teachings of Judaism that seems to conflict with human reason. And human reason in the Middle Ages essentially meant Aristotelian philosophy, and the Rambam did consider Aristotelian system to be largely a valid system, a description of reality, and the Rambam wrote the Mora Nevuchim in an attempt to reconcile certain tenets of Aristotelian philosophy, reason, human reason as that was called, with revealed truth. And the Mora Nevuchim was that attempt to talk about the nature of God. And of course, the Rambam does not adopt Aristotle, you know, lock, stock, and barrel. He certainly makes a number of issues and disagreements, but he does try to integrate the Aristotelian framework into a religious philosophy. This was in Arabic, because the people who were dealing with these conflicts were people who read Aristotle. And Aristotle in that part of the world was only read in the Arabic, not in the original Greek. This really unleashed a firestorm of controversy, because there were those who took the position that it was heretical to bring in Aristotle and to believe in Aristotle, and even the idea of trying to prove the existence of God by logical axioms undermines faith. And to this day, you will note, walk into a yeshiva Beis HaMedrash and ask for, can I see the copy of the Mora, where do you keep the Mora Nevuchim? By and large, there will not be one on the shelf. They'll have it somewhere, maybe, you know, behind lock and key or whatever it is. It's not learned that much in mainstream yeshivas. Again, there are exceptions. I'm not making a categorical statement. But by and large, it is not a widely studied work. And here, there were some incidents of the Rambam's works actually being burnt, because they were considered to be heretical in that way. And we will talk about that next week, okay? I'm sorry, so next week I I thought I was in the States. I would be in the United States. So Ellie scheduled a substitute. So although my plans changed and I could have been here next week, but since there is a substitute, a very, very excellent substitute, we'll talk about fertility and halacha, different scientific issues. Very, very worthwhile. So my next appearance will be 2 weeks. Thanks. Have a good day.